nightmare.
It's Saturday, 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and you're listening to you with your host, Avenger Satanus, and the Beast.
Hi, thanks for tuning into the news. I'm T.C. Downey, otherwise known as the Beast, and this is my co-host, Avenger Satanus. Avenger, how you doing today?
I'm doing awesome. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing incredible. I'm excited about today's show.
Yeah, this is our second show, right?
This is our second show. That's right. We survived the first one, and we're back ridiculously to do it again.
Most of our limbs are intact.
Most of them.
Which is nice.
Yeah, I would say so. Today's show is actually, we're going to try to, well, it's entitled The Devil and Misindulgence. And what we're going to try to do is actually draw some form of a connection to BDSM or fetish lifestyles and its actual symbiotic relationship with occult lifestyles. We should have Jason Sorrell calling in sometime soon. And I guess then the fun will really begin. But in the meantime, while we're waiting for Jason to give us a call, we could start off by, I guess, getting a little bit of an understanding of where you and I are both coming from.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a good topic because, really, who doesn't love fucking?
Christians? Mormons?
Yeah, but I think most of them like it even more because it's that much more forbidden to them. So it's that much more of a turn-on.
I would say that underneath everything that they'll tell you to their face, absolutely. But typically, you know, that's naughty. You're supposed to leave your clothes on, you know.
Right. Yeah, only fuck your wife through the sheet, through the hole in the sheet, right?
Only through the hole in the sheet, right? And the lights need to be off.
Right. Yeah, and they can't admit to enjoying it, I guess. So that's really cheapens it for them. So, but yeah, we're not Christians. You know, we're doing the whole left-hand path, Satanism, Cthulhu cult, etc. thing. So, you know, we love sex extra special much, right?
Absolutely. Sex is...
Where are you coming from? Why don't you talk for a little bit about what you like and what kind of sexual BDSM experience you have or, yeah, just where you're coming from.
Myself, I'm actually... I do actually enjoy the concept of... being a dominant male in a BDSM relationship, I prefer actually it being more of a master-slave type deal. But you know, I'm good with dominant submissive as well.
Like a girl or a woman, basically at your like kneeling before you, like that kind of master-slave, like
absolutely.
Okay, stuff like that. I was at a BDSM party a couple of weeks ago, and this I was brought there as with this girl. She was kind of like, you know, an escort. She's the one that got me into the party, and I've been seeing her a couple times before that, and she has a whole other master. And when she was away talking to people upstairs, I was in the dungeon portion of this party, and her master was telling me like some of the things that she likes. And, like, he told me, oh, you should tell her that you've never seen a girl in a cage before. So, and they had, like, a little dog cage, not little, but, you know, a human could fit in there easily. And he told me that, you know, you should tell her to get on her knees and go over to the cage and get inside it and show me what that looks like. And so I did, you know, just because I wanted to see what would happen because I thought, well, if it turns her on, then awesome. And so she was in the cage, and I was kind of like, you know, petting her a little bit with my finger while she was in the cage. And she was all curled up, and, you know, apparently she loved it. So, you know, she was sucking on my finger and stuff. And that was my first experience with, like, the whole master-slave thing, like the real hardcore power exchange. You know, before that, I've been with the submissive girls a lot and enjoyed that just because I'm just naturally dominant, but never to that extent where she was just like, you know, I'm worthless. I want you to beat me. You know, you're the master, stuff like that.
You loved every minute of it, didn't you?
It was really cool. For me, it wasn't so much a sexual turn-on, but aesthetically, it felt nice, and it was just cool to have that feeling, to have that power, and, you know, to have someone sort of be that submissive or that subservient to you. You know, that was cool.
Absolutely. We have on the air now, we've got Jason Sorrell from Creative Oddity Studios. Jason, how you doing?
Doing good, man. How's it going?
Oh, it's going pretty good, man. I don't know if you actually got the chance to take a look at the show's description page, but I took the time to actually post a link up for everybody to be able to click on and go to follow those points that you sent me. You were kind enough to do our homework for us, and so we wanted to make sure you got all the credit for that.
Cool.
You the man.
So I heard is that Venger?
Yes. Yep, that's me.
Okay.
Hey, what's up, man?
Hey, what's going on? I heard you talking about kind of your first experience there, and the power trip that you're describing. What you're describing it as was not necessarily a sexual experience, but as basically a definite shift in power, and probably more extreme shift of power than, you know, other situations you've been in, because it's so readily given by the other person. They just give up the power that they have in seeking their own pleasure in that to you. That's really common in BDSM and the BDSM relationships. And that's why people get into it. It's not necessarily about sex or about deviant sex or anything else. It's about that that shift in power and role-playing, you know, various roles, dominant versus submissive. But what's interesting is while you were the one in power, you were empowered by this other person, it was actually you were actually serving her needs.
Right.
And a lot of people miss that when they talk about BDSM, that they think it's a sadist who, you know, gets off on, you know, beating on people, whatever, when in fact it's more likely it's a masochist who's trained somebody to take care of those needs for them.
Yeah, that's totally right.
Absolutely. For the folks that are just tuning in and aren't really familiar with Jason Sorrell, Jason is both a pretty well-known occultist as well as someone who's heavily into the BDSM lifestyle. So that would make you the expert on this show, correct?
I don't know if I'd say expert. I guess I'm as experienced as, you know, everybody has their own experiences, and they're going to bring a unique perspective to it. But I guess I've been around the dungeon a couple of times.
So what do you particularly like, Jason, in like your own personal life, if you don't mind talking about that?
Well, sure. In the relationship I'm in right now, first of all, it's what would we consider an exclusive relationship, me and my girlfriend. But we often bring third parties, other women in. She's bisexual. I'm not interested in other guys, so it's almost, you know, it's exclusively other women. But when we bring other people in, it's still us playing with somebody else. And then we get into the bondage aspect of it. My girlfriend has a collar that she wears, and when she wears that collar, it's almost like flipping a switch. She goes from very independent, very assertive of self to just totally willing to do whatever, you know, I want her to do. There's certain limitations, and I get the same, you know, the same exhilaration that you were discussing. It's not necessarily sexual, although there's a large sexual component to it. It's more about, you know, the enjoying the power, enjoying having this human being now who's a toy, who's taking on this role of just pretty much doing whatever you'd like to do. And that's, I mean,
when she doesn't have the collar on, is that is it like, so it's not 24/7, it's just she's normal, sort of, or she's just like,
oh,
there's a normal power exchange, or, you know, like, you share power equally, more or less?
Yeah.
Or does she always
want to
control?
No, we're pretty much complete. We're pretty much complete equals when the collar is not on, when she doesn't have the collar on. So we try to make it a special experience. It's not necessarily meant to be an everyday common thing. There are people who have relationships like that, but for us, for me in particular, I would get burned out on it. It would just be it would be monotonous to have somebody that you always have to tell what to do and when to
right.
do it and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I agree. I think, if it was like 24/7, it would be exhausting after a while, you know, especially if she was really, really into pain, like some slaves or some submissives are. You know, you constantly have to be hurting them or something, you know, not only during sex, but I guess other times too, or, you know, putting them down or something if they like that. I think if it was 24/7, it would just become, like, too much.
Well, and there are people who have extended role-playing sessions where, you know, you could literally hang somebody up in a closet for hours. You put somebody in a position at a party where, you know, we talked about having a girl bent over upside down, and she would be the official party garbage can and ashtray. And that there are women who get into that, who, you know, yeah, go ahead, put that cigarette out on my buttocks. That'd be great. And they would be doing it for a long time. But then typically the people that do it continuously, it's less I'm going to do everything he says, I'm a total slave to everything he says. They seem more normal than you would think, but then it just seems like every once in a while when he wants something to drink, she gets up and gets it. When you notice when they go into a restaurant, she opens the door for him. Just little things. And it's extended foreplay for them.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, with all this in mind, Jason, you took the time to actually put together this very nice outline. And we were kind of hoping that you might sort of walk us through this and, give us your thoughts.
Because it's not enough for you to actually do our homework for us, but we want you to actually hand it in as well.
Basically, my understanding was that it was a matter of trying to find the connection between the occult and that subculture and the BDSM subculture, because there definitely is a connection in symbols and practices, in the way these people think, these people behave, and I imagine there's a lot of cross-pollination between the two subcultures. That if you find somebody in the BDSM community, more than likely they have some experience with ritual practices in the occult, and people in the occult community definitely tend to have some experience with BDSM or using, you know, sex and magic. But I started kind of with the history, talked about, first of all, you had to make the connection between sex and the occult. And, you know, way back when, during the Greek and Roman Empire, even as far back as the Egyptian Empire, you had priestesses, cults of Isis, or other goddesses, who basically the ancients recognized the sexual experience as a miraculous, mystical experience, and that these women would act as conduits for that experience, so that anybody willing to, who could afford to pay it and was willing to, you know, perform the correct tribute to the goddess, could be with a priestess who was trained in not just standard sex, but heightened sexual experiences, and would allow them to, you know, worship at that altar, basically. With Christianity coming into force in Europe, all that kind of changed. All those cults, of course, had to go away or go underground. So what you found were you had missionaries going to the heathens, going to the pagans, and bringing the good news, basically. And nobody listened. Nobody cared. Nobody wanted to hear about heaven and, you know, the eternal paradise or whatever with God or whatever. But if you started talking about hell and you started talking about the sins of fornication for fornication or whatever, you're going to you pack the house basically. So people started coming to church to learn about the sex that they weren't having. And that's how our Western sadomasochist BDSM interest really developed. Is you aren't allowed to look at your wife, but you could go to church to see a carving of a woman being, you know, basically raped by a demon. And these, you know, these played up, these fantasies were built up and built up until you know, you reach the age of reason, you reach the Renaissance. And folks like, you know, the Marquis de Sade and, you know, artists and all these different people came out and said, you know, here's the things we were looking at our church and at our churches. Here are the stories we were being told by our preachers, and we're just taking it to the next step.
And then you get the inverted Christianity, sort of like the traditional black mass, where, you know, you have sex, or the person leading the ritual or some of the participants might have sex with the women or the altars or whoever during the ritual.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. And that would be, I mean, that would just be part of the whenever something is restricted, whenever something is controlled, it's going to, the inverse is going to occur. And it's going to occur more dramatically. So the more tightly something is controlled, the more likely it's going to react in an extraordinary way. So yeah, if you're going to have an anti-Christian experience, if you're going to try to break away of that and try to gain some self-control, well then, what have you been told is wrong? What have you been told sex is wrong? And not just mundane, procreative, you know, missionary position sex, but let's do something really crazy. And crazy back then, though, was, just as you're saying, laying a woman on top of an altar, you know, anal intercourse, full view of the nude. That was radical stuff back then. That was, you know, what we would consider in BDSM a chocolate experience, you know, dark, heavy stuff. Mm-hmm. And as time goes by, that becomes more mainstream, more mundane. So then you have the BDSM culture now where it's not enough just to have a woman on an altar. She has to have leather, thigh-high boots on. She has to be tied up. There has to be some scourging going on, or it's still mundane. And even that now is becoming mainstream.
Right. Yeah, we keep going more and more extreme to get new heightened experiences, I guess, sexually, and I guess in the occult world, too, and, you know, Satanism and the left-hand path. You know,
right.
I don't want to feel left out either, right?
The question you asked last week about, at the end of the show, kind of about Satanism, has it reached its, you know, has it run its course, basically, and it's basically suffering from the same thing. It's like, you know, in the 60s and 50s, you put a picture of the devil up above your dresser or whatever and say that you worship Satan. Well, yeah, that was huge. That was a big deal. That was a real real mark on your part to step out and separate yourself from the herd. But now, if you say, you know, I worship Satan or whatever, it's like, well, yeah, and, you know, there's a guy down the street that worships his lawnmower. You know, it's not that shocking.
Right. Here's a question I have. Do you think that's because society as a whole has become more desensitized to Satanism and everything that represents the opposition? Or do you think it's because society has shifted over and is a little bit more satanic than it ever used to be? And that's why it's just not a huge deal anymore. You know, if a teenager or someone in their 20s or even in their 50s, you know, maybe wears black or calls themselves a Satanist or wears a pentagram or, you know, does rituals in a chamber or hangs out in graveyards or whatever the cliche is, do you think people don't care as much because our whole society is a little bit more satanic than it was in the 50s?
I would say from a certain perspective, it would be both, because, I mean, there's been studies now that we're definitely, as a society, less Christian. So we've moved away from that. We've become, the society's become more secular. But then we've been so, you know, basically sensory flooded with, you know, satanic images and satanic imagery that Satanism is really, you know, from the 60s to the 70s and 80s, went through a period of adolescence. And where, you know, it was meant to rebel, it was meant to shock, it was meant to, you know, get attention. And now it's reaching a point where, you know, it's all the same game over and over again, so Satanism has to move to its state of maturity. So I think, I don't know if society is becoming more satanic, but definitely more acceptant. You know, they're accepting more the idea that this,
right,
this practice is, you know, is out there. And I think they're accepting also, I mean, you could say that, like, let's say the Church of Satan, you know, built its house on the shock value of Satanism, but then went, did a really good job in going, look, we're just, this is just a belief, this is just the things we do. There's nothing, you know, outwardly evil necessarily in our actions. And that PR campaign worked really well and whitewashed Satanism enough that, you know, when somebody says I'm a Satanist, well, they don't, the next thought isn't necessarily this guy's killing babies in his basement. The next, it's just that this guy, you know, believes in,
right,
that guy who was out in California, you know, years ago.
Right.
Doesn't
that also diminish the impact? Yeah, obviously it's good to get away from the whole baby killing cliche, but what about, you know, you hear someone say like, oh, you know, I'm a modern Satanist, or, you know, I'm more the Church of Satan kind of latter Anton LaVey philosophy, like dark humanism or something. And instead of people getting visions in their head of, you know, that person's a devil worshiper, or that person is in league with Satan, or, you know, practicing the black arts and things like that, you know, letting their imagination run wild. It's kind of a letdown, I think. And it's just kind of like, well, this person has a more egocentric, selfish point of view and is maybe more realistic than a lot of people about human nature and what they're trying to accomplish in the world. I just think it's not that stimulating and it's not that exciting. And for me, as a bit more of a traditional Satanist, I guess it seems a little disingenuous, but I guess, you know, that's probably going on a whole different topic. But anyway, I like the shock value. You know, I like the shock value of, like, you know, extreme sex and forbidden acts and weird, crazy stuff from Brazil or whatever, as well as, you know, the real hardcore dark elements of Satanism, where, you know, there may be this dark force out in nature that's you can commune with and get some real power out of it.
Well, I'm kind of hoping that this moving away from screaming for attention, the adolescence of Satanism, the ending,
right,
of that actually will be a positive thing. That the people who are you know serious about Satanism will take the next step and basically work to achieve that satanic mandate of finding answers, of being independent, of moving forward and stimulating evolution in society, stimulating evolution in the self. And if that means finding things that generate that shock, that excitement in, you know, in whatever corners they find, they're doing it for themselves and not necessarily doing it to get the attention from somebody else. And I think that's the positive aspect of this shift.
Okay, no, that makes sense. I definitely feel it's good to get away from the more teenage aspects of Satanism or the left-hand path or anything unconventional.
If I could interject here for a minute, gentlemen, and kind of catch my perspective up to where you guys are right now. In my opinion, to answer the question that was posed, I think that people in general are inherently evil, and so as, you know, time has gone on and we've become less and less concerned with being persecuted for actually taking pleasure in these things that are considered outwardly wrong, or were considered outwardly wrong, it's becoming more and more acceptable to experiment and to, you know, kind of indulge in different aspects and different philosophies. And I think that that's what was was it LaVey that said we were coming into the age of Satan? Is that who said that?
He did. He definitely pushed the idea in the Satanic Bible, but I wouldn't credit him as being the source of that statement.
Okay, but it was that statement was made in the Satanic Bible. It's been a while since I've actually read the book, so.
Right. I think, and I don't know if this is what you're talking about, but I think LaVey kind of said that, yeah, this is the age of Satan, and, you know, indulgence is kind of like the highest form that we can, you know, manifest this thing. But then later after the fact, I know I've read that Michael Aquino from the Temple of Set sort of said that that back then in the 60s and 70s that was the eon of Satan, and sort of, I don't know, more codified it into like, oh, this is indulgence. And, you know, before that it was like Aleister Crowley and Thelema. But then he was talking about his own Temple of Set and, you know, Kefir and that whole thing. And anyway, go on.
Right. Okay. So I guess the whole point of what I was trying to get to was that as we've moved along and things have become more and more acceptable in different lifestyles and different ways of being, you know, tattoos and piercings are they're everywhere now. Where before it was, you know, the only people who had gone across the seas and had come back, you know, they'd done their tour of duty in the service, and you might see an I Love Mom tattoo on his arm or something like that. As people move along, we become kind of disillusioned with, you know, it being such a terrible thing. And then we move along to trying to find the next train wreck, because, as I said in the beginning, people are inherently evil, and we want to see horrible things happen, because it's something that breaks us away from our slumbering everyday conscience.
Right. Yeah, it sounds like George Carlin, kind of, like, you know, people like to see disaster and things blow up, and
they do. There's just no, I don't think there's any arguing that point. I believe that absolutely everybody is fascinated with the, you know, destruction, death, and blood.
Right.
Well, that brings us back to the BDSM discussion, because it's all about, you know what, if people see something happening. I mean, there have been studies where brain waves on monkeys have been measured, that if a monkey sees another monkey performing a certain action, like, say, throwing a stick, the parts of the other monkey, the observing monkey's brain that would throw the stick, click. They go through the same process they would go through if they were actually throwing the stick themselves. So when people see death and destruction and pain and misery and what have you, they go through the same mental reaction that the people they're seeing go through, but they survive it. They're separate from it. And there's that rush of relief. There's that internal sense of, you know, better than me, basically. And that's pleasurable. So, you know, you saw somebody die, but you didn't die. You got to experience in a small way that, but you didn't go through, your life didn't end. So that's, I believe, where we seek this pain through, you know, pleasure through pain equation. And that's, you know, that's the essence of BDSM, is that the humiliation, the spanking, the different sexual contortion, basically, all that leads to the relief of, you know, I survived it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That's why movies are so popular, because, yeah, people can experience something without actually having to go through it, you know.
It's living life vicariously.
Right.
So, I'm sorry.
I was going to say the occult connection there is, of course, a large part of occult practices is managing and controlling your own reality. And it's living life vicariously, but living life by design as well. So again, there's that connection. I'm going to manifest my own reality, and in manifesting my own reality, I'm going to have my own type of sexuality, and my own type of sexuality is going to involve, you know, leather and chains and, you know, the occasional thumb screws or something. So
yeah,
again, they're heavily wedded together.
That's a huge parallel between wanting to create your own reality in the occult world and in your own sexual life.
Let's go ahead and maybe take a look at the actual what I think is probably one of the most major connections between the two, and that is ritualism. Jason, you did an excellent job of summarizing this and this little outline, which if everybody's listening wants to take a look, again, you can click that little link right there that says BDSM and the Occult. It'll take you to a page that has this outline laid out. What I'm actually I'm seeing here is this all really ties into, once again, wanting to live vicariously. I think that ritualism is one way of doing that. In a sense, you're putting yourself outside of yourself and practicing through this process that in your mind, you know, maybe eons old, or, you know, it might be fresh, brand new, and something secret.
Right. It's like a scene of, like, temporary extreme reality, like how you want it.
Right.
Absolutely.
In my opinion, a lot of the discontent people experience is the level of control that they experience going through the day-to-day lives. I mean, the road is already laid out to them. The route to work is already determined, when they're going to be there, what they're going to do, when they're going to take the break, and how they're going to function while they're there is already predetermined, and then what they're expected to achieve when they get home to their families, how they're expected to react to their spouses, all that is predetermined. So occultists and people in the BDSM community are looking for some sort of escape where they can take a more proactive position in what they're experiencing. So in ritualism, I mean, just take the ritual chamber, for example. The ritual chamber is, you know, you distinguish that as separate from time and space outside the ritual chamber, that in your mind, this place is whole and unto itself, an entire universe. Well, in BDSM, you know, you lock the doors, you turn down the lights, you make sure that no one unauthorized can get in and get out. There's special, in ritualism, there's special, you know, you wear special clothing because it makes you feel more mystically inclined. It gives you a greater sense of this is a different reality, this is a different place and time. And in BDSM, it's the same thing. It makes you feel sexually sexy. It heightens the emotional response. So it's again and again, it's the same, you know, same parallels from one to the other, back and forth, which is why there is a lot of cross-pollination, especially now. In the 60s, it was titillating enough just to have a nude woman sitting on an altar while you were doing a ritual. Now, you're going to need a little more stimulation to get the same kind of reaction. What I'm interested in, as I do my own exploration, as I play around with these different concepts, is what's the next thing? What's the next leap forward? Because whatever's out there, as we're seeing with tattoos, with BDSM, with alternative sexuality and alternative thinking, whatever's out there on the occult frontier, that's the future for the mainstream.
Yeah.
I think, you know, obviously one of the things also that I find fascinating is it seems like the actual scenery between the two, the way that a dungeon would be laid out and the way that a ritual chamber or whatever you want to refer to it as would be laid out, they're similar. You'll see a lot of black, a lot of dark coloring,
right.
Candles and skulls and odd contraptions and obviously reading materials that are specific to whatever craft you're practicing.
Yeah, even restraints and things to keep someone immobile.
You can make it as simple as just the clothing itself. The priest is in, you know, pure black with a white collar, very pressed, very, you know, no wrinkles, no creases, very clean. And the rabble, especially in, you know, pre-Renaissance Christianity, might be, you know, very unkempt, very unclean, you know, clothes falling apart or in tatters. So there's a definite distinction, and in BDSM, the dominant tends to more often than not remain dressed or have a certain uniform they wear, and that, especially in some circles of BDSM, a uniform, a military uniform, shows that level of authority. And then on the opposite end, the masochist, whoever's the submissive, tends to have a minimal amount of clothing. Or any clothing they have is meant to restrain, restrict, or cause discomfort. So it's the same power shift, the same ecstasy that some Catholics talk about, going to church, getting on their knees, and having the host put in their mouth by this priest standing over them. It's the same experience for the submissive with a dominant who is basically playing the role correctly.
And let's take all the other aspects out of this and just kind of focus on one thing. In you guys' best determination, do you guys think that all of these common similarities are all, shall we say, a formula for the psychodrama to actually achieve this this ecstasy that you're looking to gain, I guess, you know, this form of enlightenment?
Sure, I'll try to go first. I think for me, the goal in ritual magic is to change your consciousness. And I think sexually it does the same thing. You know, it opens certain doors. It leads you on a progressive path to something that's more you, that's more your own personal reality that you want to get to, something that's deeper and further and maybe darker as it keeps going, to up the ante and you know, get more stimulation. And so I think both of them are used to change a person's consciousness, and in that way they're similar and very effective in the left-hand path sense to become what you want and get what you want and go in the direction you want.
Jason, do you have anything to add?
I agree with all that and would add that you know, keep in mind that the first mystical experience probably had by mankind was the orgasm, was that release of sexual tension. And way back when, that was the connection to the divine. That was the heaven on earth, if you will, or what have you. So now, as that's become very commonplace, very mundane, when you can achieve that experience, I mean, Crowley was all about the orgasm and magic. And when you can achieve that connection in a way that, in a non-mundane way, in a way that's even more intense. Through a BDSM process, you're opening up, you know, the same level of magic, the same level of practices that the ancients experienced. I don't think the connection, though, is necessarily intentional. I just think it's a natural process of our development as a civilization, that the more you know, the less mystery there is, and the greater extremes you have to go to find mystery again.
So you think it's kind of rooted in the unknown?
Do I think the BDSM experience is rooted to the unknown?
Both that and, I guess, magically or in a religious sense.
I think a greater part of the occult effort is trying to either achieve divinity or connect with the divine, whatever that may be, or however you might see it or imagine it. And I think that, one of our experiences that that gives us that connection or gives us a sense of that connection is sexual, is the orgasm, which is why, you know, Christianity has gone so far to try to limit its use, which is why other religions have done the same thing, have gone, you know, gone out of their way to restrict, you know, free sexual expression because it would be, it's a mystical experience. So I think you're going into the unknown. You're trying to achieve some level of exploration outside common reality.
Right. As long as there's more to explore, I guess there's people that want to explore it. I don't know if you'll ever get to a point where you're actually done. Or you've gone completely as far as you can go. And of course, sexually, there are certain things that you get to a certain point and you just want to keep doing them because you've reached that point where, you know, it's so stimulating for you that you just want to keep doing that, you know. Whether it be like, you know, having two girls at the same time, you know, watching them together, or if it's, you know, beating a girl until she's, you know, bloody or black and blue or, I don't know, whatever.
Yeah, there's
you
definitely...
You probably can't get there until you become God yourself. I don't know. That's the difference, I guess.
Well, see, the saying is you can't know what's enough until you've had too much.
Right.
And I think it is a matter of everybody trying to push their envelope, push the boundary. And part of the trick, though, is not developing an addiction, not developing some sort of need. You know, being able to step back and enjoy just the mundane aspects of whatever reality it is you're seeking and whatever it is you're doing. Because if you have to be constantly in the ritual chamber, in order to feel any satisfaction with life, well, then you're not living life. You're not making any changes. You're just imprisoning yourself. Same with BDSM. If you have to, you know, if you have to have somebody tied up to get any sexual gratification from what you're doing, well, then you've lost touch with something.
Right.
Yeah, that makes sense.
All right. Let's take a minute and do a quick commercial set, and then we'll finish the last portion of our show that, come to be known as the Undiluted Truth.
The Ooze is brought to you by the following: cultofcthulhu.net, awaken with the Cult of Cthulhu, creativeoddity.com, making art a dirty word since 1998, lulu.com/satanics, purchase publishings by Avenger Satanus, artist, author, cult visionary. Find titles such as Cthulhu Cult, Libre AO, and the role-playing game Empire of Satanus. Lulu.com/creativeoddities. Find publishings written by Jason Terrell, artist, author, such as The Tattoo Apprentice, The Baphomet Codex, and The Devil's Due. Fearthebeast.com. Let the madness begin. Catch the dollies. A vigilant, a vision. YouTube.com/iPriestSatanus. Now back to our program.
Yeah.
Okay, that was difficult not to laugh.
go ahead and laugh. It's over the top. It's meant to be self-amusing as well as hopefully amuse other people as well.
All right, so the last portion of our show, The Undiluted Truth, is going to be more of a free form. We're going to go ahead and, sort of break away from the main topic and take some time just kind of decompress. Maybe Jason would like to take a few minutes and tell us about some of his up-and-coming ventures that he's got going on. I'm sure Derek could do the same.
I don't know about you guys, but I've got a drawing of a vampire babe that I have to have finished by tomorrow.
Yeah, and I haven't even started it yet.
Oh, the Halloween art contest thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the first piece is supposed to be done tomorrow to go up on the website. So I'm rushing to get mine finished.
I haven't done any painting in, like, it seems, well, it's a long time. It's been months. I feel kind of bad. I don't know, lack of inspiration or just busy with other things. I don't know.
Yeah, it can be hard to force yourself to try to do something, you know, daily or even weekly, especially when you do have so many other things going on. It was pretty bad that I was more interested in writing that book than drawing pictures.
Yeah. Do you think your personal life has a huge impact on your output artistically?
Oh yeah. Yeah. It could go either way too. If I'm real happy about what I've got going on personally, you know, it might mean a whole bunch of artwork, or it might mean I'm just too content and don't create anything, or if I'm in a really bad place personally, then it might mean that I've got that will be the creative inspiration I need, or it might mean that I'm, you know, too busy trying to straighten things out to deal with artwork.
Right. Yeah, I feel the exact same way.
I go through these cycles, and I don't know if either of you guys experience them, but I'll just be walking along doing my everyday thing, and all of a sudden there's just this image that's locked in my mind, and until I actually sit down and put it down on a piece of paper or make it happen on the computer, it doesn't go away. It's constantly there. It almost becomes annoying in a sense.
So yeah, that's nice when that happens.
Did you feel that way too, Jason? Or
yeah, if I have something, well, if I get an idea that isn't going away, I mean, that really gets me working, because it has to be done. I have to get it out. And sometimes that will lead to, you know, 5, 6, 7, a dozen pieces, all me trying to communicate whatever it was I had in my head. But lately it's been, you know, somebody coming in and going, hey, I want a rose with my mom's name in a banner or something. And that's taken up all my energy for drawing, you know, in a day or whatever. It's just kind of, it's the downside of being a tattoo artist, I guess.
Right. Well, see that? I mean, I do get inspired, or like, I do get ideas, and I'm thinking, oh, that's a cool idea. You know, maybe I can incorporate that into something. But whenever I start an art project, or even in like a video or a piece of writing or something, not necessarily a painting, I just can't. The end product never turns out like I start it, and I kind of go into a project knowing ahead of time that I don't have a finished product, or I don't have like a concrete idea in my head when I start it that it's, you know, it's going to become this. You know, I get just like a creative buzz or an artistic vague inspiration. I just do something, I just get started, and it just becomes whatever it has to be. So for me, that, you know, that's kind of different than what the Beast was talking about. But it seems like you go both ways, Jason, with, you know.
Yeah, if I get an idea.
Hello.
What's that?
I said if I get an idea, it is just that. It's an idea. It might be, it's not purely abstract, but then once I start putting it on paper, of course, once you start seeing it in reality, then you tweak it and you move it around and you go, you know what, maybe this angle would be better this way, or maybe I'm just representing it entirely wrong and maybe I should go a whole different direction. So in art, you're communicating. So I think that, you know, yeah, if you have a message you're trying to communicate, then you're just, what you're doing is looking for the best way to say it. So it can change, it can evolve. And, I mean, Da Vinci talked about how a painting's never really finished.
Mm-hmm. That, yeah, the audience, I think, is another really important thing. If I know that there's a group of people that are expecting something from me, and they're eagerly anticipating it, that want to be entertained or frightened or amused or whatever by something that I can do, then that waiting audience really inspires me and motivates me to actually get something done.
And like the dollies.
Yeah, like that, or like anything I'm writing, or like, you know, a painting or something. But if I know that, you know, something is just going to sit on my computer, or it's just going to sit in, like, a painting, like, in my closet, and it's not going to be seen by anyone, and no one's going to appreciate it, or even attempt to appreciate it, then it almost kills it for me. It's like, sure, I can create something, like, just for myself, but I've created, like, 1,000 different things, and in the end, it's for an audience, I guess. For me, that's
yeah, most...
Yeah.
Most artists, I totally agree. Most artists definitely we're all attention whores. That it's always, you know, it's cool to have accomplished it. It's cool to have accomplished whatever technical feat we've done on paper or canvas or whatever, but it's a whole other level to have somebody appreciate it. That really makes it worthwhile. Somebody going, you know, wow, you're amazing. It's like, yes I am. I am amazing.
Or even just have someone say, like, huh, that's interesting. I don't know about that. You know, just have, like, an eye, you know, gazing on it and, like, having an opinion. That's really
right on.
And, yeah, it makes all the difference, I think.
I actually find myself very frequently in a frustrated state about halfway through completing any piece that I do, because I just don't feel like I'm capable of conveying what's actually in my mind, you know, and making it materialize. I don't know if it's just me, but in my brain, when I'm when an idea has come to me and it's something that I'm working on, it's always very vivid and very in detail and extremely in depth, and sometimes it's way beyond my capabilities. And I've found that it drives me to try to accomplish it, and that's why you'll find, like, multiple pieces of work that's similar. But
I used to feel that way too, but then I kind of realized that it's, you know, it's impossible for me to create something as awesome as I want to see it on the finished product, or as awesome as it is in my head. You know, it's never going to be as cool as I can see it in my mind's eye. So I kind of just let go of that expectation. And in doing that, I think you let go of the frustration too, because it's never going to be perfect. It's never going to be 100%. You know, maybe it's bad to talk about compromise in an artistic sense, but I feel like I have to compromise with myself all the time, you know, just to get things done, because, you know, I'm never going to churn out, like, a masterpiece, like, over and over and over, you know. If I get, like, 3 masterpieces, you know, in my humble opinion, a year, you know, that's fantastic, you know. And if I do a lot of work that's B grade, well, you know what, I just kind of have to be happy with that, because, you know, it's either that or not creating stuff at all. And I don't want to do that. I don't want to give up art because I'm not that awesome or talented.
I agree. You can't. It's good. It's a good thing to have a vision in your head that you would never be able to achieve. That that you're going to be constantly forced to develop your talents and develop your skills and your technique to get as close to that vision as you might have. And the other thing is that your vision is also racing ahead of you. That it's developing. That once you've mastered a technique, once you've accomplish that level of understanding, well, then your vision should change to that, to where incorporating that technique now, that's commonplace, and you're pushing yourself to the next edge, basically. I don't think it ever. It is frustrating, but that's part of being an artist. Is that it's never as good as you wanted it to be. But I agree with Venger. You know, I wouldn't. If I'm lucky to get a piece out that is at the level I want it to be, ever. And I really do. It is a matter of compromise and going, okay, well, this is marketable. This is. I'm satisfied with where this is at right now. If I come back to it, it'll be at a new level.
Yeah.
Right.
Which is really great stuff. Is accidental. You know, it feels more like, you know, the right pieces fell into place kind of on their own, you know, by accident than pure design. And that's, you know, it's interesting when it happens that, you know, like the dollies, you know, I didn't have that in my head. Like when I went to Goodwill to, you know, and found those dolls, I just kind of, you know, shit just sort of happened and fell into place. And, yeah, some people like it, and that's it. It's just kind of, you know,
right on.
Real quick, because we're almost out of time here, I've only actually myself achieved, I think, two pieces in the entire time that I've been doing visual art that were actually satisfactory to me. One of which is an image that what's that?
I said, no, you haven't, man. Hang it up. I'm just giving you a hard time.
Yeah, I gotcha. No, there's just the two. Yeah. Just that the one that was called Save Face, you know, the girl's face that's kind of distorted, and it looks like she's got this metal contraption around her mouth.
Right on.
That one, and then that collaboration between you and I. That's the only other piece that I was ever like, wow, that came out really awesome. Everything else is, you know, it's always just a couple grades below. You know, so with all of that in mind, we've only got about 2 minutes left in the show. So, Jason, I'd really like to say thank you for coming out. We really appreciate the fact that you did our homework for us and pretty much carried the show.
it was pretty easy from our standpoint, yes.
Well, thanks for having me on.
And you got everybody who hears this in archive or is listening live, go to creativeoddities.com. He's got a ton of shit for sale. You can take your choice, anything from skateboards to T-shirts to posters. You're actually quite an accomplished author as well.
Yeah, it's coming along.
So check it out. Buy some shit from Jason. Venger, thank you for showing up again.
Well, hey, as co-host, it's kind of my obligation. Thank you, anyway.
And that's pretty much all my thank yous today.
Cool. Yeah, I think a good show. Just being number two. And do we know what we're going to talk about next week?
Yeah, I think we're going to actually, we're going to discuss masks, the metaphysical, philosophical, and archetypical perspectives of them.
Okay, that sounds good.
All right. Anything else?
Nope.
All right, we'll talk to you folks next week. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Ooze. Opinions expressed by our guests or callers do not necessarily reflect those held by Venger or Beast or any institution associated with us. The Ooze does not condone any illegal or unethical acts. If you have been offended during the production of the show, we're sorry, but as the old expression goes, tough luck. Thank you, and see you next week. Face the things that you're
I got to hang up and call you right back, man.